welcome to a special bonus episode of The Sacred. We are doing an Ask Me Anything, and you have sent through some wonderful questions. Thank you so much for being in conversation with us. I'm always, you know, slightly worried that there might be complete silence, but no, rather the opposite. We have had many, many questions, and they have got me thinking. I've been muttering about them walking around my house, but we sadly are not going to have time to answer all of them. So we have selected ones that we hope kind of represent some of the breadth of the questions. And if you ask me more than one question, thank you, but you're only going to get one answer. Maybe we can keep being in conversation about it. And it's going to be really fun today because I'm not here on my own talking into a camera. I am joined by two incredibly important parts of the Sacred team, our wider production team, Dan and Amari. And they're going to feed me some questions, maybe help me answer some questions. I might put them on the spot a little bit. I'm going to have a lovely chat. So let's kick off.
Awesome. So we have our first question, which was sent in by Brendan Lake 1522, and it was about the panel conversation that you had before Christmas, hosted by Jack Symes. And he has said, I watched a recent conversation with Alex O'Connor, and there were atheists who were clearly missing the point of your contribution to the conversation. I was wondering how you felt about that discussion.
Yes, so I have written a long essay about this over on my Substack called Just Call Me Token Woman, because I found that conversation really stimulating, really interesting, and quite uncomfortable for a range of reasons, which I lay out in that Substack, partly about gender and partly just about my approach to things, which is not, as this, as you rightly kind of spotted, necessarily the same approach as someone like Alex O'Connor or even a philosopher who was also on the panel like Philip Goff. Both of them I really like and think are really interesting thinkers, I really respect. So it's not a kind of like, I didn't find it uncomfortable because I think they're bad or terrible. I found it uncomfortable because the approach that I tend to take with these kind of big metaphysical questions, and for those who haven't seen it, it was the last, it was on our stream at the end of last year, but the title was Between God and Atheism, Cosmos, Consciousness and the Meaning of Life. Just like, terrifying as a title. But they're, you know, they're the biggest, juiciest, deepest questions, right? And the traditional way we do those in public was, you know, very much the framing of that debate. These quite intellectual, philosophical, propositional, evidence and argument-based engagement. And I've done some of that and I can do it, but as regular listeners of this podcast will know, the thing I'm more drawn to and the thing that I find more fruitful is the kind of tone and space we're trying to create here, which is very happy saying, I don't know, you know, very comfortable with that, trying to develop epistemic humility, trying to kind of approach things, assuming that there's stuff for us to learn. And with a kind of imaginative, intuitive, emotionally attuned approach to these questions. And so trying to bring that in a space that wasn't necessarily framed like that was tricky at times. And you can go check out that post. But largely where I'm left with it as we go into this year with what we're trying to do in the Sacred is there was lots of encouragement from that as well. There was lots of people who wrote to me, including atheists, saying how much they valued and enjoyed just a different tone and a different approach to bring some diversity. And so even though quite a lot of people clearly didn't like it, I am hoping that between us, we can keep going in this space, offering it for the people who it's fruitful for. And if it's not fruitful for people, then they don't have to listen. That's fine.
Well said. I've gone ahead and already changed the order just because I realized one of the questions leads in very well with that.
All right, bring some chaos. Bring some early January carnage.
So we had a question from Chelsea Stanford. Thank you, Chelsea. Who wrote, I listened to Elizabeth's interview with Freddie Sayers where she described how doubt and uncertainty should not exclude one from Christianity. Uncertainty and doubt aren't given regular attention in the Christian circles I'm part of. I'm wondering if Elizabeth has any advice or suggested reading with this spiritual tension and perhaps finding peace amidst it.
Whew, thank you, Chelsea. Yes, you're right. I have come to a place where this no longer feels like a fight. And your question was incredibly helpful for making me go, okay, how did I get here? And what is the journey that a lot of people go on? And, you know, there's various bits of kind of theory around this, both in sociological terms and theological terms. And there's a kind of stages of faith thing where people are like, when you first get converted, and I only really know this within the Christian context, but there may well be other frames for other people's paths. But, you know, when you first get converted, everything seems very sharp and clear and sure. And then often at some point you hit a sort of dark night of the soul, valley of the shadow of death. Where is God? Is any of this actually, you know, is there any truth in this? Is there any goodness or wisdom in this? And I think if you've not been prepared for that, if your understanding is that like sense of doubt or abandonment or withdrawal is, if you think it's basically a loss of faith, if it's a fork in the road, you know, you've been on the path and now you're off the path, then that's when a lot of people do say, okay, this isn't for me, and they give up. There's a lot of chatter moment around deconstruction. Some people would frame it like that. But the more I read about how people have lived this kind of thing down the centuries, the more my understanding has come to be that that's not the ending. In some ways, that's just like a second beginning. that's a dropping down to a deeper level, and that the sense of the presence of God, in my language, the sureness, the steadiness of the faith ebbing and flowing as part of the walk, as part of the journey, is there in all the writings, all the mystics, but also just like the great witnesses, the great women of faith, women and men of faith who I draw such comfort from. They all talk about it, right? They all say, like, Mother Teresa had decades where she was like, where's God? Who knows? I'm just going to keep loving the people that are in front of me. And so, yeah, reading this. So, okay, I think maybe just realizing how normal this is. And then poetry. Poetry is really my answer to most questions. I can't say poetry to every question, but poetry as a really wonderful and helpful container for some of these spiky, complex, compacted emotions and experiences. You know, reading R.S. Thomas in particular, which I've been reading a lot in Advent, Gerald Manley Hopkins, John Donne, like anyone who is wrestling with prayer and love and doubt and faith. Honestly, I've never read a good religious poet for whom doubt's not a big part of their themes. Because the best poetry is really honest. And I don't know anyone who's been in my case, a Christian for a long time and not come up against the dark night of the soul and the wrestling with doubt. So yeah, the stories of the saints and poetry and the Psalms, obviously I would include the Psalms in that poetic canon, maybe the beginning of the poetic canon.
I thought there was something really crucial in what she said as well about the fact that in her Christian circles, she doesn't find that there's necessarily a lot of space or conversation around this as well. I wonder, because I've definitely found that, and I found that I've had to work quite hard to find people who are able to walk in that place with me with a sort of curiosity, not a sort of anxious, oh, you're not one of us anymore. But I do wonder where that comes from in the first place. Like, maybe it's a sort of, we're coming out of this new atheist phase of the world being quite antagonistic towards religious belief, towards Christianity. And so therefore, those who are that kind of remnant feel a lot more in need of certainty. And so in a sense, that's almost the time that we're living in. We really like certainty. There's a lot of questions. And even beyond religion, if you just look at the big collapse in trust in institutions in general, people find it difficult to have faith in establishment figures, establishment sort of entities. And so but in that space, instead of being open then to uncertainty, a lot of people feel like they need to just clasp onto something so that way they feel secure. So finding people who feel themselves freed from that or are able to walk with you. I know that's been absolutely crucial for me to maintain any form of sanity.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. That there, I mean, there's a deep psychological human need for more certainty than life can ever provide. And it feels to me like just growing up psychologically in general, let alone spiritually, is a slow increase in our tolerance of uncertainty, right? Our ability to feel uncomfortable feelings and not freak out, blame someone, blame ourselves, shut down, withdraw. And that, you know, that there are some personality types and some temperaments, for, you know, we all have our own struggles and sins. And for some that comes easily, for some that really doesn't. Some people's formation means it's easier. And it's harder for other people. And some bits of the church really struggle with this, but they have gifts as well, right? The bits of the church that have more tolerance of doubt and uncertainty have their own areas in which they could grow. So I kind of don't want to do a slightly patronizing, you know, the bits of the church that have no room for doubt are just emotionally immature. I don't mean that. I just mean that I think both the walk of faith and just becoming an emotionally healthy adult requires us realizing that certainty is just not something we were ever promised by faith, by the world. And so trying to create it is often when we do the most harm.
Mm. Do you think we also oversell conversion a little bit in terms of what that experience will do for you as a person in terms of experience some kind of, I mean, you can, and many people do experience a deep transformation, but I do think part of that then kind of dark night of the soul, sort of resistance that comes on later as you get to a point where you realize, okay, there was this big experience, but actually underneath it, I'm still the same person with a lot of the same problems and still very much a frail, problematic human being. And so then when you come up against that, you're like, wait a second, I feel like I've had a bit of a sleight of hand deal here where I was promised this deep transformation as a person and that hasn't necessarily happened. I've still got a lot of work to do. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What do you think, Mari?
Yeah, it's like the dark night of the soul wasn't quite accounted for on the storyline of what faith or religion was meant to look like. And I think that kind of adds to like the loneliness and bewilderment of it, of gosh, I feel this thing that wasn't really meant to be part of the trajectory of this. And that can be a really lonely experience, and I've definitely experienced that. And I think, yeah, I think it's all quite tribal. It's like staying in the people who worry about that are kind of staying within their tribes, and like when you're outside of that, then I just think finding your own tribe is really important. And I think when you look for it, you do find other people who are willing to be vulnerable about uncertainty, and they will kind of have similar thoughts. And I think a lot of people are just kind of choosing the certainty route and like not wanting to think of the things underneath, because that's quite scary. So I can definitely find myself in both camps, being like absolute certainty or like total doubt. So
yes, because that's the unhealthy otherwise, right? Like the I think acknowledging the dark night of the soul and the role of doubt in faith, if there is a certain trajectory which just dissolves everything, right? And I sometimes liken it to being married or in a close romantic relationship. Like you fall in love and you commit to each other, and then there are times when the feelings are not, you know, super rosy. And assuming you've made a good choice in the marriage and you still think it is the right long-term trajectory, you keep choosing it. And I feel like that often with my faith. I'm like, sometimes I'm full of doubt. Sometimes the church is making me pull my hair out. Sometimes I'm making me pull my hair out. Sometimes the great suffering and tragedy of the world. There's many things that can make me feel shaky about it. But I ultimately believe that orienting myself towards this star, right, that this path, this direction is towards the good, right, is towards love, is towards helping me become the kind of person the world needs. And even when I don't necessarily believe there's someone whose arms I'm going to fall into if I keep walking in that direction, I so want that to be true, and I'd rather take the punt on that than be like, fine, nothing, you know. The other thing I would say, I think you're really, that's a really helpful thing about conversion, because I think in Chelsea's question, or it might be one of the others, it's about actually some people who haven't got a background in faith or maybe walked away from it in their childhood, we're having lots of listeners come along and say, I'm sort of tentatively walking towards the possibility of faith. And for lots of them, they haven't had this big conversion experience, right? They haven't been overwhelmed like I was in this sort of ecstatic experience. And I think it's in this question, certainly in other people I've talked to, Nick Cave, we talked about this, right? He was like, there is a sense in which people think I can't commit myself to faith if I'm doubting, right? If I have any doubt left, then I have to stay here on the fence, on the edges. And actually, I think you're right. There are these other kinds of conversion. David Brooks talked about this. He was like, his becoming a Christian was like a very long, slow, gradual thing. And he said, it's like being on a long train ride and looking back and realizing you've crossed a border. And so, yeah, I think normalizing that it can be part of the story right at the beginning as well. It's all about stories, isn't it? It's like what our expectations, our stories, do we see ourselves in other people's stories? It's how we make sense of the world.
Awesome. I feel like that that links quite well into our next question, which is around loneliness. It's by Nick Rathmeyer. I might be butchering your name, so I'm so sorry. But he says, I have been researching loneliness as part of a master's degree and have found that loneliness exists in people living in communal societies as well as individualistic societies like the US. I've wrestled with the idea that loneliness can be both a fundamental part of the human condition and that it also needs to be addressed. I'd be curious to hear Elizabeth's perspective on how we move forward.
So this was a really helpful question and also definitely did like challenge one of my assumptions, that what we need, the solution to loneliness is more community. And I don't really know the answer. My like completely ungrounded gut level response to this question, or maybe I should put it as this is my working hypothesis in response to this question, is that we need two slightly different things to target loneliness, or rather maybe to flourish. And they are community and intimacy, and they are nested but different things. And so we talk a lot in the community about kind of concentric circles of commitment to people, and that my kind of like, and this is all through Fully Alive, my kind of deep sense of the most important thing we need to flourish is connection, is these I thou moments of feeling us like seeing and being seen, knowing and being known. And for me, the like fundamental ground where I find that is in my faith, and that with a small number of people in our lives, consistent knowing and being known, seeing and being seen, is like air and water to the human spirit. And we need it. And we also need to be embedded in these networks of like mutual care. And we need to be seeing people not like us on a regular basis. And we need to be knowing our neighbors and part of local civic institutions and in community in the way that most healthy societies over many centuries have done, and that we in this weird, privileged, prosperous part of the West are slowly forgetting because all of our needs for those are being outsourced and monetized. But I wonder if highly communal and communitarian societies are really good at the second, but the really close, tender intimacy of the small get slightly downgraded because you're around more people all the time. And hyper-individualist societies are better at the intimacy in theory because they put so much emphasis on romantic relationships, which is really great for those who it's working for and less good for those who long for that and can't find it. And less good at the kind of wider network of community. So I have no idea if I'm right, but that's what that very helpful and interesting question has made me wonder.
Yeah, I also think there's a pre-step to community, which is around self-work and the idea of like being seen and being able to be in community is so lovely. But I think there's that step before where you kind of have to learn how to be seen and how to feel seen. And I study counselling outside of working for the Sacred, and that's kind of a lot of what we talk about around like kind of getting to that authentic self. And I think it can be very lonely when you are not in touch with that authentic self, and therefore in community, it like just something isn't working. And like, yeah, so yeah, there's that like pre-step there around authenticity and learning to be seen and be known by other people.
Yes. Yeah, you can be in like physical proximity with a lot of people a lot of the time, and yet everyone's guards are up.
The next question we have is a video from Diary of Devotion. So we're just going to play that for you now.
Hello, Elizabeth, and everyone at the Sacred Podcast. You've inspired so many people outside of Christianity, as well as within it, with your commitment to cultivating love of God. We here at Diary of Devotion are Vaishnav Hindus who share the purpose that you've pursued so well, to know God and to love Him. With this similarity in mind, my question is, what do you think of Christian exclusivism, the idea that Christ is the only way to go to God? In your view, are Hindus like us barred from attaining God, or is there room in heaven for other faiths whose aim is to love God alone? May the Lord continue to bless you and your listeners. Jai Shri Radhe.
Well, thank you so much for that question. I'm just so grateful that there are people in this community who are following such different paths, and yeah, I'm really, really moved by that question because it's honest and direct and goes to something quite big, right, for a lot of people, and kind. I sort of wish I knew your name. Okay. So the honest answer to this question, and I have thought about it a lot, is I don't know. And I'm more and more comfortable, and it sort of relates to some of our other questions. I don't know. This feels above my pay grade. And a lot of things do now. I think when I was first sort of struggling with theological issues and questions, and this also applies outside religion, right? Those of you who are not at all religious, of which there are quite a lot of you too, and we're delighted that you're here. Feels like the story that our culture tells us is that you need a really strong opinion on everything. You need to decide what you think. You need to pick a team. Changing your mind is a bad thing. You know, that shows weakness somehow. Confusion means maybe you're just like intellectually inferior. In religious circles, that shows up as you're woolly or you're unserious about something. And I'm just slowly letting go of all of that programming and all of that coding. I think, how could a finite human created mind possibly have a strong knowledge of everything? And particularly these things that are, I really do think, beyond us. So the undergirding frame for all of this is I don't know, and I sort of don't mind that I don't know. What my kind of foundational things are, I want to take Jesus seriously, and I want to take what he said about himself seriously. And so in saying I don't know, I'm not saying it doesn't matter. I'm saying I don't know how to read this very enigmatic figure. And Christian exclusivism, you use that phrase, is often grounded in this phrase of Jesus, which is, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Which, pretty direct, right? And I don't, even though that makes me uncomfortable, I don't want to therefore go, la la la, I just won't read that bit, right? I want to take it seriously. I want to hear it and sit with the challenge of it and what he might mean to it. And I don't know if it's helpful to know, you may know more than me, but Christians have kind of responded to this in a range of ways. One is what I think is what you're gesturing to with this phrase, Christian exclusivism, which is, unless you explicitly, and it's often used, this kind of language, acknowledge Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, you cannot come to God. And that is one kind of honorable and straightforward and widespread reading of those texts. And it understandably, for those who are not someone who would say, be able to say that about themselves, it's a really hard thing to hear, right? It's a hard position. It's deeply uncomfortable. But it doesn't mean that's not a legitimate way to read those words. And then there's other bits of the text, which gesture to something slightly different. You know, in my house, there are many rooms. There are those who are not of this sheepfold. Jesus says a bunch of other enigmatic things about people, which Christians have sometimes read as balancing, moderating, deepening, complicating. Those words about no one comes to the Father except through me. And other ways of reading it have been kind of, you can come to Jesus without it necessarily being under that label or under that language. So I think someone like Richard Rohr would talk about Christ consciousness, that the Spirit of the Son of God at work in the world shows up in the life and death of resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the Spirit of God is also at work in lots of other places. At different parts of my life, I've believed different ones of those. And as I say, I currently don't really know. And I also, and you gestured to this thing at the beginning of that beautiful question about, you know, that there are listeners to this podcast that come from all different faiths. And what I'm trying to hold is that it's possible to have a kind of rooted, particular commitment, in my case, to Jesus, and hold a hospitable, interested, curious, open posture towards people who believe other things. And we might actually believe things, like I'm sure there are some things in Hinduism that would cast doubt on what I believe as a Christian. But that doesn't mean we can't be in connection and communication and friendship and relationship. And maybe that's just a really woolly answer, but that's my honest one.
I think that's good.
Nailed it. Fixed it.
Nailed it. Fixed it. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a tough one. And probably varies as well, depending on what church denomination you find yourself in terms of what kind of an answer you'll get back.
The reason I think I often get accused of being a fence sitter, and you know, that's fair. But the reason I kind of try and hold on to the not knowing is there are things I don't want to get let go of on either side, right? And I don't think it is. So the thing that I sometimes come back to is in The Horse and His Boy in the Narnia stories. I don't know if you've ever read them. But as far as we can tell from that, C.S. Lewis held this kind of slightly heterodox position on this, at least for kind of hardcore evangelicals, which is someone from another faith says to Aslan, you know, someone says to Aslan, like, how can this person come into your kingdom, essentially, because they've been praying to this other god? And he's like, they thought they were really praying to me because they're doing it with a pure heart. And it was me all along. And that's the kind of narrative summing up of this. Yes, it's all through Jesus, but you don't need to necessarily use the language.
Yeah, but also on C.S. Lewis, I find it, his book, The Great Divorce, was massively enlightening to me on this, in terms of the way in which he looks at heaven and hell, hell as a sort of eternal inward facing, and not opening yourself up to others and ultimately to God, and heaven as the ultimate sort of opening yourself up to relationship with God, and the journey in between the two is less about having done or said something in it, and it seems to be more of an orientation, and I find that to be very compelling, because it sits more realistically within what I experience of myself and what I experience of other people, in that you can see some people, they do really stupid things, but they have an orientation, which is I want to be oriented towards the good. I want to be oriented towards God. I want to be oriented towards a discovery of what there is out there. And they might be, you know, if you look at the journey on like a line, they might be very early on in that line, but they are open. And then you've got some people who just aren't. They are closed. They are inward facing. They are solely focused on what will bring them, you know, fulfillment and happiness, and not sort of a broader, more open thing. And I think, yeah, in in terms of answering this really complex question, that's something that I often come back to. But I also think it's difficult because you don't want to be stuck in a place where you're answering it because of what makes you most comfortable, if you know what I mean. That it's easy to sort of just say, oh yes, I am a universalist and I think everybody is safe, because that would be really, really nice in many ways, and it would save you having to necessarily commit yourself to anything. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I really value about the Bible is it calls me into question, right? There was another question we had that was about, like, how do you try and keep sort of open and hospitable, but not just like be making God in your own image? And I'm really aware of that, right? The temptation to that in me. I think maybe something I'll add, and this relates to the conversation I had with Alex O'Connor and Rowan Williams and Jack Symes that we mentioned earlier, is that I think the response to I don't know from Christians who are really clear that they know, that they hold that sort of exclusivist position that was referred to, would be like, you're not loving your neighbor, because if this is true, you have to like get the news of Jesus to them immediately to save them from hell. And it is our like sacred responsibility. Like, this is true, it's uncomfortable, but it's true. So the way we love our neighbor is we tell them so that they can be saved. And that's the sort of classic impetus for evangelism and mission, or at least framed as such. And if that is what you believe those verses mean, then yes, like, absolutely. And it's not that I don't believe that in my not knowing, one outworking of the not knowing is that we go, oh, like, none of this matters, right? It doesn't matter. We don't need to worry discerning what the path is or what wisdom is. And I think that there can be a lack of moral seriousness in that. But the line at the end of that debate, which was really funny, was Alex was like, you know, if you knew all this wasn't true, if you knew there was no heaven, wouldn't you give up on this whole thing? And I was like, absolutely not. Like, I don't spend that much time thinking about the afterlife. For me, it's now, right? It's a relationship now. And the reason actually I do want to and spend quite a lot of time talking to people about Jesus is for the now, right? Because of the beauty, and not because I'm like, here, I want to save you from future hell. It's, there is goodness and beauty and wisdom here that I have experienced in all my fragility and brokenness. And if you want it and are interested, I'm not going to talk to you about it if you clearly are not wanting it or interested, but I want to share that with you because it's good, right? And so I think, again, something in that question that alerted me to something in my thinking was, for me, it's so much of this faith is not really oriented about the afterlife. It's not that I don't care about that or think that doesn't exist. It's just not upfront for me. Interesting. Am I skirting heresy?
I'm sure someone will tell us.
Someone will.
There's a good one here from... Where is it? Muhammad P1D9M on YouTube. Why are you not Muslim? You are intelligent, intellectual, and well-read. There you go.
Thank you very much, Muhammad. Genuinely, I really take it as a compliment. Both the context and the question. So one of the really lovely and interesting things about last series is that because we interviewed Dr. Tim Winter, we had an influx of new listeners who are Muslims. That has been, I think, our best performing episode ever, or one of our best performing episodes ever. Which, given it was a sort of delightfully nerdy theological discussion about Islam, it's fascinating to me. And so, yeah, if you're listening to this and you're a Muslim, we're really happy that you're here. And quite a lot of the comments on YouTube was something along these lines. Like praying for you to become a Muslim, which is as someone who knows that kind of response in the Christian context was just sort of lovely and quite funny and moving. Why am I not? I'm sure there's lots of sort of pragmatic questions like where, you know, influences like where I was born and who I've come into contact with and what I've been exposed to and the stories that I've been shaped by and my formation. But leaving aside the things that I have no control over, I think the answer is that I do sort of think Jesus is who he said he was. And I'm very compelled by him. And one of the beautiful things about Islam and those conversations like with Dr. Tim Winter is we Christians and Muslims hold Jesus in high esteem. It's one of the points of connection and commonality that we can find across what is often perceived as a deep divide. Like, well, how do you understand Jesus? And how do you understand Jesus? And it's if we're able to not get into triggered defensiveness on either side, it can be a really enriching and interesting point of connection. But ultimately, I don't believe Jesus was just a prophet. I think he was who he said he was. And that's at least my conscious reason for why I'm a Christian and not Muslim.
We've kind of touched on this one already, so you might not have anything more to say on it. But there was a question from Michael Hart, which was on one of our YouTube shorts, which was, how do you have a relationship with God and not make him who you wish him to be rather than who he is?
I mean, I think I'm probably always doing that. And see, this is why I want to talk about being spiritual and religious, because for me, the kind of spirituality of my faith is that kind of contemplative practices, is this what feels like often a very deep and tender personal connection. Which often is kind of beyond words and beyond concepts and not really like focused on the details of doctrines. It's just about worship and sitting at the feet of Jesus. That's a very Christian phrase. Sitting in a sense of divine love, right? Trying to do what Martha was doing and doing what Mary was doing in that Mary and Martha story about, you know, busyness and stress and distraction. You know, one thing is needed, and it is to sit and be in relationship, right? Be in connection, be in the presence of love with a capital L. And the wider frame or container of a particular sacred text, a particular set of rituals and practices, and crucially for me, a community of other believers, feels a really necessary container for that spiritual experience. And so honestly, it's such a like old-fashioned basic thing to say, but like reading the Bible and praying and being with other Christians is a really helpful check for my massive flights of fancy, for my attempting to smush this thing into the shape of my own personality, and for challenge of where my ego and where my anger and where my fear, all of which kind of get in the way and cloud and warp something that I think is good and true and beautiful that we see in a glass darkly, right? That none of us ever are seeing the fullness or this in clarity. And that, I think my answer is only be alongside wise others that you're seeking to grow with and be aware of the risk of this.
Yeah. Agreed.
we're solving all the massive theological doubts.
Okay, we've got a question. Two more. We've got a question from Jeff Proudley, who asked, should I pray for particular outcomes when I've prayed for particular outcomes in times of illness, crisis, and when life was crashing down around me, I didn't get the outcome I wanted. What's your take on it? We also had a lot of other questions to do with sort of war and problem of evil type stuff. So yeah, hopefully this helps answer some of those as well.
Yeah. So I find prayer such a fascinating thing, and I'm aware that lots of these concepts have led me into my Christian theological framework and lots of listeners are not that. So please do add in the comments or connect with us, kind of enrich our understanding of how this shows up in other people's lives and traditions. But because I think prayer is a universal instinct. the cry, the like cry of our hearts. We're not sure who to. Yes. Anyone who's been praying for a long time can't avoid the empirical realization that not everything we pray for is delivered to us. Sometimes in trivial ways and sometimes in like devastating and heartbreaking ways. And it is one of the deep, deep questions of my theological tradition. Why is that? And you can chop it in different ways about God knowing best what's right for you. You know, everything working out as it should, or there's evil at work in the world and there's opposition. There's some battle going on. Again, I'm going to come back to, I don't know. And then the question becomes, so why keep praying? Like, what? And you feel this whenever you're praying for someone who's sick, right? Someone who's grieving, someone who's in despair. That is there any point asking? Is there any point asking for healing? Is there any point asking for comfort? Is there any point asking for anything? Question really becomes real to almost everyone who takes this path seriously. And this is where I'm going to sound my most like straightforwardly old school evangelical. I keep praying because Jesus said we should. Right? And I trust him. I don't know why. Like, as far as I can see, they're like, ask for anything in my name and it shall be given to you. I can't quite see that, like, working out in obviously clear ways. I'm sort of laughing, but in a slightly blackly comic way, if I'm honest. But I know he said to pray. And he said to pray in quite a particular way, actually, like, this is the prayer that I've given you. And these are the things that you need. You need to recognize God. You need to be reconciled to each other. You need to confess the darkness in your heart. You need to give thanks, and you need to ask for what you need today and not worry for tomorrow, right? And so the times when I can't get my head around intercessionary prayer, I just pray the Lord's Prayer because that's what he said. And that seems good to me. And then I pray also because I know it changes me. And if you have no theological frame for your prayer, but you're wondering about prayer, you can see it as attention training. You can see it as a form of meditation. You can see it as a turning your attention, which is the greatest power and gift we have, towards the good, towards something you hope might be there, or maybe you don't even think is there, but you believe this practice of attention and meditation is good for you, which I think there are many, many studies to show it is. And so it sort of works on many levels for me. The times where I have faith that even though I don't quite see it right now, all these things that you ask in my name will be given to us. The times when I don't know how to believe that, and so I'm just praying the Lord's Prayer, and I'm just praying out of a form of relationship tending. And the times when I don't believe anything, but I'm like, I still think this is the place I want to orient my life. And so I'm going to keep going, and Jesus said we should. He seems pretty wise. I might be really honest for... I pray a lot, but it does go up and down between all those reasons.
So we have our final question here, which is from Michael Wiltshire via email. So we love that. And he said, what is sacred to the sacred? Which is kind of a fun question that we can take in lots of different directions.
I'm laughing because they're like, via email, we love that. It's so like our social media manager, Jen, said person is like, look, we got a pigeon carrier letter. It's so cute.
I think emails making a comeback. Just putting that out there for 2025.
Really on trend.
Yeah, it's on trend. It's on trend.
Trend predictions.
Was not a DM. Yes, thank you, Michael Butcher Esquire, for your correspondence. What is sacred to the sacred? So I am going to ask you two to tell me your guess on what's sacred to you. And if you are not ready to ask that, you can say what you think is sacred to the sacred. But I've talked a lot about what's sacred to me, so I'm not going to repeat that. But the wider project, And this is one of the things we're hoping to say a bit more about and do a little bit more direct kind of explanation about later in the year, is really rooted in a kind of nonviolent tradition that is, for me, grounded in the New Testament, but has been kind of used by lots of people from lots of different worldviews and paths. And it is heart very, very basic. It's a commitment that every human has dignity and beauty and value. And therefore anything that is, whenever we allow ourselves to indulge in contempt or stereotyping or disdain, particularly for groups of people, individuals too, but I think the real danger is the, like, this kind of people, those guys, whatever it is, you know, the wokesters, the white men, the, yeah, I don't even need to give you those examples. So one of our kind of deep fundamental commitments, and this is grounded in my kind of theological commitment to the Imago Dei, but again, you might be grounding it in something else, is that every human being is worthy of our attention, essentially. That every human being has something interesting to say, that every human being has a story and a set of values. Well, it's making me quite teary. That there's treasure. There is treasure and glory in every human person, even the ones that we find very difficult and disagree with us and are driving our bonkers and might have acted very poorly. So that's sacred. The power of listening is sacred. That it sounds soft and weak and inefficient and is actually magic. The power of a good question, an honest question, that's actually seeking to understand rather than prove a point or get someone to say something that you need them to say for your edit or for your reel. It's a temptation. And I think the epistemic humility thing, that I have so much to learn and I have received so much and I want to chew on that, but I also have lots to learn and there's, and again, in my language, the spirit is working the world, right? That there is beauty and goodness and holiness in all these lives. If I just shut up for a bit, let other people speak. And on that note.
I think I'm always so thankful that I don't have to answer the question, what is sacred to me. when we're editing the episodes, I'm always like, well, phew, I don't have to answer that. But now my time has come. And
we gave you a 6-month run up.
And it's tricky. It's so hard. But I think that my sacred thing is maybe more of a feeling. And it's around resonance and the idea that, like, or like the feeling of when something resonates with you deeply. And it could be from something I'm reading, it could be from a conversation. And it could be from someone who is of a completely different tribe, but when they say something that just, like, rings true on, like, a bodily level, for me, that is a really, really sacred feeling. And it kind of just seems to transcend all the differences. You just suddenly feel really seen and heard. And yeah, I just find that really beautiful. So
yeah. There is a book that you might want to read called Resonance by Hartmut Rosa, which I found in Rod Dreher's book. And he says some beautiful things about resonance as that helpful language for that moment of, like, oh yeah, that's landed.
Yeah. Ooh, I'd love to read that.
We'll put it in the show notes. Yeah.
I think for me, I've found for the past couple of years, I just sort of wear the hat or wear the value of the whatever every guest says. And I'm sort of like, oh yeah, that fits a bit. But I think the one that I heard that I've found I most deeply resonate with is one that I haven't heard since and I don't think came before either. And it was Christy Watson's value, which was comedy. And I think just the ability to laugh at things, especially yourself, and just the ridiculous things that happen in life. I think, one, it can turn sour, sort of not nice situations and make them a lot lighter. And you realize that you just don't have to take everything so seriously. But also just on a simple level, even if it's not laughing at negative things, but just sitting down and having a laugh with my friends, with my wife, with my family, making people laugh, laughing at other people's jokes. I just think there's something absolutely magical about that.
Yes. Yeah, I do feel like that. Take the important things seriously, but don't take yourself too seriously.
Yeah.
Always think we're all a little bit of a joke. Okay, that was fun. Thanks, friends.
Enjoyed
do this
that.
More often.
Some nice little light questions.
Nice light questions, yeah. Woo. I love this. I love our listeners. Nothing boring. I think that's all from us for now, and we will be back with our new series in a few weeks. We're looking forward to talking to you. We have
next
some
week.
Very juicy conversations with you next week.
Yep.
Not long to wait. But in the meantime, I don't need to show you who the production team are because we're all here, except Lizzie Harvey. And we'll speak to you then.